This evening I wanted to give a talk which is carrying on from a question which was asked this morning when I was talking about perception. And it's carrying on the understanding of why sometimes that we can have perceptions which seem correct but which turn out in truth to be other than the way things truly are. And how the world can actually be full of delusions, even though they appear real to us, that we're seeing in them something which isn't there. And that which we're seeing there is that which is created by those things we call defilements of the mind. And the topic of this talk is a very important part of the Buddha's teachings, called the vipalasas, being the literally the perversions of the mind. Please do not regard that word as anything to do with like sexual perversions, or unfortunately that this is the only real word which we can find for this category of the Dhamma which the Buddha pointed out, because this takes the data of sensory experience and changes it, bends it, warps it. And so what's actually presented to our mind, what we become conscious of, is not really what's there. And these vipalasas or perversions are the explanation in detail of the meaning in Buddhism of avijja, or delusion, ignorance, not seeing clearly. And one should remember that avijja, that the illusion, delusion, ignorance, not seeing clearly, was always pointed out by the Buddha to be the root cause of all that is suffering, that the root cause of dukkha. Blinded by ignorance and led by craving, that the uninstructed, the unenlightened being wanders around in samsara, always experiencing suffering, dukkha, now here, now there. And it's blinded by ignorance, fettered by craving. It is the ignorance comes first, the delusion comes first, and as a result of that comes the craving. The craving for things which illusion or delusion convinces one is going to be a source of security and happiness and contentment, but which never really fulfills its promise. But still, it propels the mind always to seek outwards for its fulfillment, for its contentment. And that seeking outwards is called craving. It causes us to grasp onto those objects which we think will create happiness, and to push away those obstacles which we deludedly think are standing in the way of our fulfillment, and creating this whole activity of the mind which consumes one's attention, causes one disappointment and frustration, a few moments of joy, but which certainly makes one revolve around this thing we call samsara. So avijja, or ignorance, delusion, I prefer the word delusion, is that which is the primary cause, even before craving comes in. And to understand what that delusion really means in the Buddhist terminology, how the Buddha meant that word to be understood, and the sort of delusion which is the cause of the arising of craving and consequent dukkha, the cause of delusion which keeps us getting reborn, searching for fulfillment ever here and there, that the Buddha described this as the vipalasas, the perversion, that which distorts. And these distortions affect three things. They affect one's perception, and one can look at perception as the primary distortion, And it's this reason why it ties in with the talk I gave this morning on some of the perceptions which one can deliberately develop, and why it ties in also with some of the training in the jhanas, which is a training of perception. And so playing around with perception and understanding this will give one an insight into one of the purposes of doing jhana meditations, and how it will lead to an investigation into perception and an investigation and illumination into how perception can be distorted by defilements. Now the perception is the first thing which can be distorted by the defilements. The second thing which can be distorted by defilements is the thoughts. The thoughts do not go straight to the point, but you think and you come to conclusions which are distorted by the defilements. Even the thoughts do not assess and judge the situation as it truly is. Even though it appears that one's thoughts are assessing correctly, if it is investigated thoroughly, one sees that the distortions, the perversions have been at work, and the thought has been bent away from the truth of the matter. And so the second aspect of these distortions or perversions acts on thought, the citta. And the last of these perversions, the three perversions or distortions, acts upon view, one's ideas, one's views, one's opinions about various matters, either worldly, philosophically, or even spiritually. And I will mention in a moment just how this occurs, and how the defilements actually pervert the views which one has, and which obstruct one from seeing clearly. You may remember that the Eightfold Path, which is the way to enlightenment, that which should be practiced and cultivated and made to become, starts with samadhiti, right view, correct view. And sometimes we're not quite sure the meaning of that term. Samma, correct, right view. Then it means a view which is free from the perversions and the distortions. It truly is seeing things as they really are. But it's very difficult to arouse that right view, because these distortions happen at such a deep level inside of us that we don't know they're going on. It's the great difficulty with delusion is that we don't realize we're deluded. Delusion has no indicator or sign which comes up and say, yeah, this is delusion happening. Delusion seems to be accurate and truthful. A very good simile of this, which I've mentioned to a few people, is given by one of the monks who I knew for many years, the Venerable Ananda, in American monk. He used to be a soldier in the Vietnam War, and in the Vietnam War he got shot in the back of the head, as well as getting some shrapnel in the helicopter when he was being evacuated. As it was, he was quite badly injured. His life was saved, and the doctors told him when he first woke up that he's liable to be blind completely. But when he recovered from his operation, bandages were taken off, and to his great delight and exuberance, he could actually see. And when the operation was finished, when he was reasonably healthy and recovered, he got pensioned out of the army and lived a life just enjoying himself on the pension he received from being an injured Vietnam veteran. Anyway, the point of this story, which relates into perception, he told me that he has a blind spot in his vision. and that for many months he had no idea at all that there was a blind spot in his vision. It was only, he said, one day he was playing baseball, he was fielding, and one of his friends hit the ball high up in the air, and it was going towards him, he was going to catch it, and the ball in its trajectory towards him suddenly disappeared. It just vanished into nothingness, and then later on, a few seconds later, it appeared again. And I don't know whether he said whether he caught it or not, but he realized that there was a part of his vision which he could not see, a part of the field of vision which had been taken away. The point was that it did not appear to him as like a blackness in the sky. In fact, he could not see that that part of the vision had been taken away. It was only through inference, through knowing that the ball just doesn't vanish into blank space, that it was actually travelling, but that area where it was travelling he just could not see, and he couldn't see that he couldn't see. And it's a very good simile and metaphor of how delusion works, that one simply cannot see that one is deluded. The only way that delusion can be seen is, I was deluded, once the seeing has been spotted. At the time, it is completely invisible, which makes the delusion such a difficult, almost impossible thing to uncover and remove. And that's why it is the origin cause of all that is a problem, which the Buddha uncovered and eradicated. Seeing the delusion eradicates it immediately. And obviously that you would know that that uncovering the delusion is called enlightenment experience. Seeing the delusion, and understanding, having seen it, how this delusion works, understanding why one couldn't see it for all those lifetimes. Now, the delusion, as I was saying, is expressed and most beautifully by the Buddha in terms of these vipalasa or distortions. And the Buddha pointed out that these distortions in particular distort four truths in each of the three levels of perception, thought and view. First of all, it is the distortion which takes that which is impermanent to be permanent. It is a distortion which takes that to be suffering as happiness, or as producing delight and fulfillment. It is that which is not yours, not you, which doesn't belong to you at all, which is not self, which you take to be me and mine. And it is the delusion which takes that which is ugly, not beautiful, to be something which is delicious and lovely and delightful to the senses, which takes the impure to be pure. So it is the delusion on these which confuses these four things. Confuses what we know as the three characteristics, the anicca, dukkha, anatta, and the fourth, asupa, or the ugly, impure, which confuses these with their opposite. Now, why does it do this? Why does it confuse and pervert, say, the impermanent, that which is unstable, to be stable and permanent? The reason is because it wants to. It wants to find some stability in this world. Craving wants to find somewhere where it can hang its hat on, where it can rest. A stable ground for one's fulfillment, even for one's peace. And that desire to find stability, to find permanence, is so strong that will even create such illusions as, say, a permanent heaven after we die, even though that is illogical, irrational, and create all sorts of philosophical contradictions. Still, many people believe that. Why do they believe that? Because they want to. Craving can be so strong that it will pervert the perception, it will pervert the thoughts, and it will pervert the views. It starts on any of those levels of cognition, perception, thoughts and views, and works in what you might call the most vicious of vicious cycles. That once the defilement convinces or perverts perception, and so you see that something which is going to change, you through desire, through craving, you see it as permanent. The young man and the young woman falling in love and promising, "I will love you to the end of time." The person who finally finds some beautiful place to stay in and deludes themselves to think this is going to last forever, this happiness. People actually believe that. The person who, born in this body, has an idea that this body will last forever. You may think, "I don't have that idea," but you'll find that what you think on the outside and what you think on the inside are sometimes very different. Once your body is threatened with sickness or death, once its impermanence is threatened as a reality, then you can see whether deep down, not what you tell others, not even what you tell yourself, but what actually is the truth of your perceptions, thoughts and views. Sometimes you find out, actually, I was taking this body to be permanent. That's why I'm suffering. That's why I'm threatened by the fact that this body is going to pass away. The reason why one is under the power of this delusion, because it is a threat that, for example, the body is going to pass away. It's not a pleasant thing to face up to, especially if one has put so much effort, time, so much vested interest in maintaining this body. If one has got so many things to do, so many responsibilities and duties. "I'm too young to die now," is the common complaint in the romance novels. And you ask any person, even in their 60s and 70s, "Still, I'm too young to die." As one person put it, many people, old people, are ready to die tomorrow, but not today. And one can see here that is the craving for further existence, for the vested interest in keeping hold of this body. No, it's just this body. There are many other things in the world which one takes as permanent. And again, one knows those things which one takes as permanent when they get threatened, and one feels the suffering, the conflict. Why is this going now? Why is this leaving? Why is this passing? The shock when something dear to one dies or gets taken away. That is showing that the perception, the thought, the view was distorted. That somewhere one actually thought that that being, that friend, that loved one was permanent. One was deluded all along. If that delusion was not there, if one truly perceived, thought and viewed that being as impermanent, if one knew that fully, when that being passed away, there would be no tears. There would be no shock. There would be no great grief. And someone rang up and said, "Uncle George has died." "I expected that." Not, "Oh my, oh dear." So, do not deceive yourself. Do not even pervert the perversions to think that I haven't got these things. If one is yet unenlightened, there will be some things which by their very nature are impermanent, which craving, defilements will make you see as permanent. In particular, the things of the mind, which delusion takes as being permanent, when in truth they're changing so fast. And once the Buddha said that if one is going to be rational, that at least one would could almost expect people to assume the body is permanent, because at least it lasts for 30, 40, 50, 60 years. However, anything in the mind, the Buddha says, doesn't even last a second. So how can people rationally take anything of the mind to be permanent? But they do. And what's the main thing they take to be permanent? Me. The I, the self, the soul, whatever you think that is what you take to be permanent inside of you. Your personality, your character, who you take yourself to be. Sometimes your consciousness you take to be permanent, sometimes your choice you take to be permanent. Sometimes your happiness you expect to be permanent. And when it goes, it just adds suffering to suffering. So the Buddha was saying that delusion takes that which is impermanent to be permanent. First on the level of perception. Despite all the logic, all the rationality, you perceive maybe the body to be permanent. You forget the Dhamma, you forget the teachings of the Buddha, you forget all that you heard, because the defilements are stronger than that, and they make you perceive that this is permanent. As one person said, when they told me they were diagnosed with cancer with only a short time probably to live, that all their Buddhism, all their Dhamma went out of the window, out of the hospital window, as they grappled with the truth of their immortality and tried to deny it. Even though that they've been practicing meditation and had heard about impermanence, and they could probably even give a good talk about impermanence, when they actually came down to it, their perception did not live up to their external understanding. We're going to a deeper level than our externals. We're going to the heart of ourselves and how perception often shocks us, and we actually see things not according to the Dhamma of the Buddha, according to defilements. The mind becomes dark to the Dhamma, and the defilements are just changing the perception. And that is why that sometimes seeing things the way they are should not be trusted unless one is an arahat. Very often people will convince you, I've seen the way things are. And in all ways, I'm not just talking about philosophical or spiritual matters of Buddhism or whatever. You ask a born-again Christian, they've seen God, and there's no way you can convince them otherwise. Someone else says, I've seen Allah. Someone else says, I've seen Krishna. Someone else says, I've seen Kuan Yin. I mean, who's right? Logic, reason tells you they can't all be right. But understanding delusion shows you they're all wrong. The delusion which perverts even perception, and you think you're right, you perceive you're right from perceptions. The way we perceive, this is the basic data of our mind, and from perceptions we build up our thoughts. Now as we perceive, we look at the sky, we perceive blue, we look at the grass, we see green, we look at the food, it's delicious. And we, all these perceptions, all these labels which we give to our experience, the way it surfaces in our mind, the way that sensory contact surfaces in our mind, and how we're aware of it, You know, you should know that we're only like choosing half or even less of reality when we perceive. We look at someone, and to some people that person is beautiful, to another it's ugly. Some food, for some it's delicious, and some it's gross food. Now, is that deliciousness or grossness part of the food, or is it part of this delusory activity of the perversions? And much of the world is these affective judgments of permanent, impermanent, happiness, suffering, mine or not mine, beautiful or ugly, the stuff of the perversions. So once we actually perceive in a perverted way, it builds up our thoughts about this. What we perceive becomes the bricks by which we think. And those thoughts become like the houses. And those thoughts build up our views. Many, many thoughts, many, many rationalizations, little arguments, logical arguments based on our perceptions, what is our direct experience to ourselves, or what seems to be a direct, truthful experience. We build up our thoughts. And from those thoughts, those homes, we build up the cities of our views. And understanding that the views themselves are based on false perception, you can understand how there are so many diverse views in the world. And how that even two Buddhist monks sitting next to each other would have diverse views, let alone people of different faiths, different countries, different genders, different perceptions. And once one understands that diversity of views, where it's all coming from, you can start to understand that how the views themselves work on perception. As you view, so you perceive. And one of the interesting little contemplations which showed this, I think many of you know this metaphor, but those people who have out-of-body experiences, if they're Christians, at the end of the tunnel, the light they see is Jesus. If they're Muslim, they see the Prophet. If it's Buddhist, Mahayana Buddhist, they see the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin sometimes. And it's interesting reading, I forget what book it was many years ago, of out-of-the-body experiences in different cultures. And to see that there was a basic similarity of the out-of-the-body experience, in particular the beautiful light at the end of the tunnel or passageway. But what was fascinating for me was the name they gave that beautiful light. And those people swore that it was Jesus they saw. And you ask them, you talk with them, and there's no way you can convince them out of it. Why? I actually saw it. I perceived it. I was there. Look, they can't argue with my perceptions. Why did they perceive that light in that way? Because of their views. The views which we have affect the way we perceive. If you're a Buddhist, then that affects your perception. You perceive the world in a particular way. It directs and aligns, points your perception. You go looking for certain things. So when you understand that how this cycle works, how from perceptions we build up our thoughts, from thoughts our views, from views the perceptions, and see this whole thing going round, and you wonder how on earth it can be broken. And indeed, it's very difficult to break this cycle of delusion or perversion or distortion of reality. And again, as far as the Buddha was concerned, the distortions which really affect our well-being is taking that which is impermanent to be permanent. And how often do we find ourselves shocked? Because we always look for our happiness, for our security, for our rest in the permanent, We want the partnership, the relationship, which is going to be permanently happy. We want the the home, which is going to be perfectly safe. We want the body, which is going to be perfectly healthy. We want the state of enlightenment, which is going to be perfect for all of time. We really seek for our happiness in the permanent. And when we find out that that permanence is a delusion, we feel sold short. The salesperson has tricked us, and we feel suffering. That which was promised to be happiness, we find just fades away. Or that inside of us which we take to be ourselves, we find that's not me, that just goes. What can I rely on? It can only be something which is permanent. That which changes, that which is always fading away, how can you rely on that? Also, and perhaps even more powerfully, the fact we take that which is suffering to be happiness. On the level of perception, thought and view. I've mentioned before that this whole activity we call life is a search for happiness. And you've already known many instances when you thought that something was happy and it turned out to be dukkha. When you've invested time, effort, money, energy into an activity, you perceive that this is happiness. At last I found love, I found contentment, I found peace. And you find it turns out to be dukkha, suffering. And we're still searching for that which is truly happiness. Why do we crave and why do we go around grasping and attaching onto things? It's only because we think, oh, at last this is happiness. There's many things in this world which people crave for and spend all their life working towards, which even you would be able to see as this dukkha. People who work so hard, who go through enormous amounts of pain and difficulty to win the medal in the Olympic Games, for their team to win the trophy, for them to find happiness in love, for them to find riches. And just how much effort in the world is pointed in these areas. And do people really find happiness? Or are they mistaking that which is essentially dukkha as happiness? They can perceive this, they can think this, and they can view this. At the time when the champion stands on the podium and hears the national anthem and everyone cheering them and the cameras on them, it reminds me of a very beautiful cartoon which I saw in a New Age or alternative magazine once. There was like a boxing ring and it was a martial arts contest, and this young man had his arm held aloft while his opponent was stretched out on the floor unconscious. "I'm the world champion," he exclaimed in a little bubble. And that was the first frame of the cartoon. And the second frame of the cartoon, the area was enlarged to include not just the two people, the contestants, but including the referee and the ropes around the ring. And you can just see on the edge of the frame a few television cameras. This was the World Championships for some martial arts contest. And you saw that the little bubble in his speech was just a little bit smaller as the area of the cartoon had enlarged. And you could see in smaller writing, "I am the world champion." And the third frame of the cartoon was even larger. It took in the whole room with all the audience cheering. And you could see the television cameras and their crews. And in the middle was a small boxing ring with the winner standing up and the loser stretched out, and the little balloon was even smaller still, but you can still just make out, "I am the champion, the world champion." The next frame was of the big skyscraper in the city where the championship was being held. This was already so big You couldn't even see the bubble. The next frame was the planet Earth. You couldn't even see the skyscraper. And the next frame was the solar system. The last frame, the universe, just stopped with stars. Where was the happiness, the achievement, the I am the world champion in the framework of the great cosmos? Sometimes we take that which is not true happiness to be bliss. That which is dukkha we take to be happiness. To really be happiness, it has to last these momentary satisfactions, is what the Buddha called dukkha. But we can perceive, we can think, we can even view these things as being happiness, and we can spend so much energy and time on that quest. And what is it truly? It's just a quest for dukkha. And so what do we expect when disappointment and emptiness come? The emptiness of the champion the day after, or the week after, when someone else is in the newspapers. The emptiness of the lovers, you know, when they're already married. The emptiness of the person who's won the lottery and spent the money and thinking, what next? So very often that because of defilements, because we're hoping so much for happiness, we give this experience the benefit of the doubt. And we're not critical, we don't use our wisdom, and we get fooled. The defilements pervert the perception. We can even perceive it as happiness. You ask any person in the pub tonight, are you having a good time? Yeah. But I think everyone here realizes that's not happiness. You ask anyone who spent a lot of money going on an expensive holiday, did you have a good time? They'd always say, yeah, I had a marvelous time, no matter what sort of time they had. The pressure was on them. They spent so much money, they feel such a fool to say, I spent all that money and had a terrible time. And you're not supposed to have a terrible time if you go to some beautiful island or you go to Europe. It's accepted that holidays are fun. And because they're accepted that holidays are fun, that you'd always even perceive it to be so, even though sometimes it can be great disturbance. This is the way that our defilements change the truth. We don't see things as they truly are. We see things as we want them to be, or as they're generally accepted by the world to be, as other people think they are. So often that the perversions act like sheep. We are social beings, and we take the views and thereby the perceptions and the thoughts of our peers, of our society. We see in the way that we've been taught to see, conditioned to see. And that's not always the true way, the real way, the correct way. So these are the perversions and how they work. And it's not only in happiness and suffering, it's also in perhaps the most important area. We take some things to be self, to be me, to be mine, when in truth they're not. We even perceive them to be me, to be a self. That is why that when I teach the investigation which uncovers the truth of anatta, you have to ask yourself, what do I perceive as myself? Not what is the self, as some philosophical inquiry, but in order to uncover the Vipalasas in action, what do I perceive as me? What do I perceive as mine? As in my power, as part of my possessions? What am I unwilling to let go of? My home, my loved ones, my body, my mind. Are you willing to let go of your mind? If not, that's which you perceive as being yours, being mine, or being me. And the Buddha was saying that this is probably the most deeply rooted and most pernicious of all of the vipalasas. The distortion of taking that which is not you, not yours, doesn't belong to you at all, as being I, me, mine. If you can uncover that and see the things as they truly are, see what is yours, if anything, what is me, if anything, what is mine, if anything, if you can truly see that, then it's called enlightenment. Because there are some things which one takes as mine, there will be craving for those, protection of those, aversion when they are challenged, when they're threatened. The person who has no possessions is the person who has no craving and has no business in the world. They are the peaceful ones, the ones who truly left the world and are not subject to suffering. The possessions of the world are all subject to impermanence, and because of that they're subject to fear and suffering. Fear when you have them, suffering when they're taken away. That which you think you control causes great frustration when you try your hardest and you find you can't do it. Can you control your mind? Can you control your thoughts? Can you just will yourself and say, today I'll get into jhana, this morning I'll get into first jhana, tomorrow second, on, what's tomorrow, Thursday, Friday, third jhana, Saturday, fourth jhana, and Sunday morning, I'll just get enlightened just in time. That's my plan. Can you will that? You find that these things are not in your control. This mind of yours, so close to you, you think, at least I own that. And logic, I mean, the Dhamma is screaming at us again and again and again. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not a self. But logic or experience is not strong enough to break the perception, the distortions of perception, the distortion of thought, the distortion of view. Because experience will be perverted by defilements. The defilements will take the truth of your inner experience of mind, will twist it around, and will give you the impression that you are in control of at least something. It will give you the possession that you own something. You may remember the interesting delusion which happens in hypnosis. I mention this because this is a very well-known phenomena that if someone is hypnotized to do something weird and strange, which they wouldn't normally do, say a man is hypnotized to take down their trousers during a talk and expose themselves, and you ask them afterwards if they're hypnotized to do this, and they're told to forget the suggestion, and then during the talk they actually do that stupid act, and you ask them why did they do it, it will appear to them that they chose freely to do that. They give some justification or reason. The distortions, the perversions, will make it appear to them that their choice was theirs and belonged to them, was part of their self. The perversions are that deeply rooted. Now, having described what makes up the delusions, the delusion of permanence, the delusion of happiness, the delusion of me or mine, and the subsequent craving which that develops, you come to the question, how do you stop all of this? How do you get beyond delusion? And especially, having gone beyond delusion, how do you know that delusion has truly ended? And this is not another delusion which you have got lost in. The Buddha taught that this thing called avijja, this delusion, has no beginning. No beginning can be found to this thing we call delusion. However, even though it has no beginning and something which brought about that delusion. The Buddha pointed out it has its food, its nutriment, which keeps it going. You cannot find out where it started, but at least you can know what keeps it going, what sustains delusion. And the Buddha said that which sustains delusion, it's an old friend which, or an old enemy which you know about. I talked about it a morning or two ago, the five hindrances. The Buddha said it's the five hindrances which keep nourishing illusion or delusion, just like it's the wood which nourishes the fire. If the five hindrances are continually present, then delusion will always be very strong. And this very important teaching of the Buddha was just one more occasion where he showed that the way that you break this cycle of illusion, of convincing you of the opposite of the way things truly are, is by eradicating the five hindrances. The eradication of the five hindrances is such an essential and beautiful description of what we mean by the path to enlightenment. Those five hindrances, how are they eliminated? By the Eightfold Path, by practicing virtue, by practicing samadhi, by practicing wisdom. And in particular, the middle one, samadhi, is what eliminates them temporarily. And this is the most important role of samadhi practice, is eradicating five hindrances. Because once the mind has achieved a certain amount of letting go, a certain amount of detachment from the outside world, a certain amount of ability to sustain its attention, that which truly obstructs the seeing things clearly, the five hindrances, that which obstructs wisdom, the defilements of the mind, has been abolished for a short while. That is where one sees. If one has abolished the five hindrances, you start to see the world in a completely different way. If, after you've developed some degree of samadhi, to the point the five hindrances are overcome, you look at the body, this is just an example, your body, and it looks completely different. You regard it in a different way. Very often, sitting in deep samadhi, you look at the body and it's very clearly not yours. If anything, you're identifying with the mind, and this body is just something you've just dropped for this while. And having separated yourself from it, from a distance looking at it, you can see very clearly that all of those aches and pains, the itches, the demands of the body, they're not yours. You've separated yourself from them. And in that separation, in that gaining of a perspective on them, you see them as they truly are. When something is very close to you, like the nose on your face, you can hardly see it. You separate yourself from it, then you can see it as it truly is. The distortions, the perversions are overcome through the abandoning of the five hindrances. Not only you see the body in this detached, interesting way, a way you don't normally view it, but you also see the mind in that interesting, fresh sort of way. You start to, through samadhi, you start to see the rise and fall of all of the mental parts, the five khandhas. You start to see that consciousness is just a process when you're not so close to it. You start to see that thoughts are just that, which things which arise because of perceptions. And even perceptions, you start to see just the way the mind picks and chooses from reality. Very often what it's interested in seeing, what it wants to see. And that is why that by developing samadhi, and I've given this simile before, it's a very beautiful simile on the development of insight, and it illustrates how through samadhi, through the ability to sustain awareness, you get deeper than your normal perceptions. the perceptions which are perverted. You look at an object, and with a bit of samadhi, you notice what first appears to the mind, what it first chooses. Look at any object, look at the nearest part of the wall, and what's the first perception which arises? It's red, maybe, or sort of, you know, all unsmooth, these are clinker bricks. Keep on looking. If you sustain your attention, the superficial perceptions fade away, and you start to see deeper. As long as you sustain your attention, more and more perceptions come up. And you realize that even though you've seen that brick before, all those other qualities which you see later through sustained attention were there all the time. But the mind only chose to see just a fraction of that brick. All of the qualities, all of those perceptions which arise through sustained attention are there all the time in that brick. But through momentary attention to that object, we just see the most prominent perceptions, which are the perceptions we're looking for. The perceptions which the defilements are looking for, which support the views, which support the thoughts. In an argument, what do? You pick up all of those bits of evidence which support your view, those which challenge your view. You always tend to disregard, or at least lessen. That's just an example of the way that distortion, defilements affect one. We always tend to support our views, justify them, by selectively choosing perceptions, choosing thoughts. So this act of perception is selective according to defilements. However, if we can maintain attention, I just gave an example of a brick. If we can maintain our attention on any phenomena, we find that those selective perceptions come up first, but we do not take those as the whole story. We continue looking. We look deeper and deeper and deeper, and we see that those perceptions which arise first are not the whole story. In fact, we look so deep that we find that there's no end of perceptions there. And especially we know that that which we thought of as a perception of permanence, as a perception of happiness, or the perception of me or mine, we see that that is not the whole story at all. Even though that challenges the way we want it to be, even though that challenges our views and thoughts and the old perceptions we had, through sustained attention, you cannot resist the conclusion. It's only through the sustained attention on phenomena that we finally uncover the truth. And it's a simile which I've given of the lotus flower opening up in the morning sun. If the sun maintains its heat and warmth on the lotus flower, the outer petals will open. If it continues sustaining its heat, the next outermost petals open up. Continues sustaining its heat, the third outermost petals, the fourth outermost petals. In the thousand petals lotus, which is our mind, it is covered with so many thousand layers of delusive perversions. We have to allow all of those to open up until we finally see the truth, the jewel in the heart of the lotus. Finally, the sun shines long enough on the lotus that the innermost petals open up, and we finally see the truth about phenomena. And what's that truth? That all phenomena are impermanent. That all phenomena are dukkha, but all phenomena are not me, not mine, not a self. That's not what we're looking for, that's not what the defilements want to see. And it's one reason why I say that insights will always shock and shatter your world. However, it's best to have an illusory world shocked and shattered, and actually to get over that shock and shattering, because afterwards the problem is solved. Through the sustained attention born of the eradication of the defilement, through the eradication of the five hindrances rather, there that insight, enlightenment insight arises. And our perception is, the first thing which is purified is our views. Sammāditti, correct view, arises first in the purified Eightfold Path. That's why that Sammāditti is put at the head of the Eightfold Path. Sometimes you might have thought, like I used to think, why does the Eightfold Path start with Sammāditti? Why doesn't it start with the morality, first of all? like the Sammā Vācā, Sammā Kammanta, Sammā Jīva, the right speech, the right livelihood, the right action. So the right speech, right action, the right livelihood. Because the Buddha used to teach in that order. Doing sila first of all, morality, and then samadhi, and then wisdom last of all. However, in the Aryan Eightfold Path, the Eightfold Path of the Enlightened One, it begins with the arising of Sammāditti. The perversion is eradicated on one's views, first of all. One reaches the correct view. One has seen the heart of the lotus. One has experienced what nirvana means. One knows the conditioned nature of this mind. One has seen dependent origination. One has seen dukkha. Then the views are purified. However, that's what we call the stream enterer. The stream enterer is not fully enlightened yet, even though they've seen anatta, they've seen nirvana. Why aren't they fully enlightened? It is because the view is purified, and the purification of view affects perception. So does the old views affect perception. One finds that the stream enterer, the once returner and non-returner, are still struggling with old conditioned perceptions, the old habits of seeing things in the light of me or mine, in the light of happiness, in the light of permanence. That's why Venerable Ananda, when the Buddha died, cried. He was a stream enterer. But he forgot the Dhamma at that time. The correct view which he'd seen, the understanding which he'd purified, was not enough, and was overwhelmed by the old view. That conditioned his perception. However, because the right view has been established and the perversion of view has been eradicated, it can only be a matter of time before that view manages to turn around perception and purify it completely, and for perception to purify thought. It's only a matter of at most 7 lifetimes for the stream enterer to become fully enlightened, for the right view to fully percolate into one's way of perceiving and thinking. Just like in the ordinary world, we can sometimes know that something is wrong, but perception arises so fast that we forget and we perceive in stupid old ways. We can sometimes catch ourselves quickly and stop that perception after it's occurred. We cannot stop it before it's occurred. And even thoughts, silly old thoughts, which might come up, even though we know they're wrong, they are echoes from the past, old ways of thinking, old ways of perceiving, and our new views have yet to percolate through. Even though the smoker knows that smoking is wrong, the reason why they take up the cigarette is because at that moment they perceive that maybe it's not all that wrong. After a while, when they're convinced that smoking is wrong, that view will eventually percolate through, so that when they pick up the cigarette, the view affects their perception and purifies it. So this is what the how the defilement affects the perception, thoughts and views, and how those perceptions, thoughts and views are finally purified in the enlightened being. And once those thoughts are purified, the enlightened being knows that they are purified. Not only does one experience at last happiness which is truly permanent, being the experience of nirvana, as if one's search for happiness has ended, and one knows, one can see that which is permanent, one can see that which is non-self, and one confirms this by experience. At any moment the arahat can turn to the deathless, to the bliss of nirvana. And so rather than life being a bit of a confusion, promising one thing but giving something else, and happiness always being just one step beyond you, always beckoning, but always just as soon as you go towards it, it's stepping further back. The arahat, the happiness is there. They know that they've fulfilled the path. The goal has been done, achieved. And that is the experience which shows that one is not living in delusion anymore. The ignorance has been overcome. One looks back and sees that delusion, and then one wonders, just the great fortune of having overcome that delusion which is so hard even to see. Like the blind spots in Ajahnananda, only afterwards did he know that was a blind spot. So that's quite a long talk this evening about the delusions, the perversions, the distortions of perceptions, thoughts and views, which is the Buddha's explanation of avijja, delusion. And it brings in why the eradicating the five hindrances is so important as a means to unearth these distortions of the mind, and also why you should be very careful of taking that which appears to you as being truth. If the five hindrances are overcome, continue your investigation until, like the thousand petal lotus, you actually do get to the heart of the matter. If you stop on the outermost petals, or even the innermost petals, you will still not see the Dhamma. Any questions or comments on this evening's Dhamma talk? Left you speechless tonight. Okay, if there's no questions, I'll stop the tape.